However, now here is Robert Zimmerman. Robert, welcome back to the program.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
Yeah, good to have you.
I'm very glad to be here.
We have many space-related matters to discuss. However, before we do, 60 Minutes did a real walloper tonight. It was, I believe, their third segment, and it was on climate change. Now, in the past, when you've been on the show, you've been kind of a...
Skeptic
on climate change, skeptic certainly on man's part in it, skeptically, as a general rule, you've been skeptical on the whole issue. A lot's happened between then and now.
Yeah.
Any comments on, the whole Hansen business, the 60 Minutes, all the reports that have been in since we last spoke? Have you moved?
Well, this actually ties to space a little bit with James Hansen's uproar with NASA and their public relations department
Yes.
a few weeks ago. And it ties into where my skepticism always comes from. Any journalist who is honest about these facts, when you dig into the facts closely, you recognize sometimes how slim the conclusions you often hear, such as on CBS Tonight, how slim the facts are that they base those conclusions on. In the last, I'd say, 2 years, there has been, I don't know how to say this without making it sound like the evidence is too strong, there's been an increasing preponderance, and that's too strong even, but there's been more evidence implying or suggesting that there is increasing temperatures on Earth. But once again, if you study the situation very closely and you talk to the scientists who are doing the actual research, a lot of them, you get a sense from them that, yeah, maybe that's happening, but they're the real down and dirty guys. They're more skeptical. They're willing to say, well, we need to do more research.
Well, actually, one of them that was there tonight said, listen, we really want to particularly thank the skeptics, because they've forced us to check and recheck and be damn sure of what we're saying before we say it.
Yes.
And their position was, it's not a maybe anymore. This is happening. In fact, one of them said, even if we were to stop all the emissions dead cold on Earth today, we would still, for hundreds of years, experience warming with dire consequences.
See, the problem with what that guy said is very, I find, in a sense, a little humorous, because
humorous?
That's exactly what the pro-global warming people were saying about 10 years ago. We now know for sure, and we thank the skeptics for having to check, forcing us to check, but we now know for sure. But the truth is, you have to separate the information available about what's going on versus those who have, quite honestly, partisan motives for what they're doing.
Well, that said,
yes,
you've got them too, right?
Yes, without question.
I mean, you're partisan. Let's get that out of the way.
Yes, I'm partisan. When it comes to science, the research facts, I'm looking for the facts. I want to know. If I was purely partisan, I would have started off to saying, nope, there's no global warming. It's all Democratic Party politics.
Well, you were saying that a couple of years ago. You were virtually saying that.
A couple of years ago, what I was saying was that the facts are not in, and there is not a consensus. Mm. That what's happening now is, it appears that, I don't know if a consensus is the right word, but the skeptical scientists are saying, well, if any direction it's leaning, it's towards global warming. Mm-hmm. But even there, they're willing to say, oh, we don't know. I'm open to the facts here, without question.
All right, without question, here's a fact for you. They showed two photographs of the North Pole.
Yeah.
You know, the ice up there?
Yeah.
One taken, I think it was in the 70s, and the other one taken in 2005. And, hey, brother, a lot of that was gone.
Yeah, but that doesn't, you see, that is not, those two photos don't tell you anything.
They don't.
Zero, because the...
Really?
That's right, because the North Pole goes through cycles of little ice for periods of time, sometimes hard to pattern. I'll tell a story having to do with exploration of the islands in the North Pole area when the British were trying to find the Northwest Passage.
Yeah.
They would find on a year-to-year basis it very unpredictable what channels would even be open. Sometimes it'd be completely open and they could sail. The very first guy who tried to reach the Northwest Passage got 80% of the way there in the 1820s. It then took almost 50 years before they could even match his voyage because the ice was inconsistent. So just two photos like that don't tell you anything.
This is getting back to
what I said a few years ago, which is to really understand what's going on here, we're going to need several year, decades more of data to see the pattern over time. And they've only been studying the global climate globally from satellites and from global sources since the late 70s.
Well, our Navy...
It's going to take another decade to really have a sense of this. And even then, it's only a 40 to 30-year time frame in global periods. You see climate changes like this, take a long time to show themselves. And you can have fluctuations over a 30-year period that might have nothing to do with a real global change. And so you need time to really know. And the scientists know this.
Why do you think the U.S. Navy is presently laying out plans to navigate because it's all going to be water and no ice?
The Navy, if they're smart, they're taking no chances. They're going after every possibility. They want to be prepared because if it does go away, they have to be prepared to be able to navigate it to do the defensive work they need to do. Mm-hmm. If they're not prepared for that, they're not doing their job.
Now, if we're going to have massive climate change, if that's in the cards as a possibility sooner than you think, then kind of like the Navy, shouldn't we be preparing as best we can with agriculture and other things that will change and affect our ability to eat and, things like that?
You know, Art, I always used to joke about this because even in the 60 Minute, they talked about how, it'll go up a foot for our children and another foot for our grandchildren and then, a foot a generation. Well, we're not going to be standing on the shore drowning as the water comes in over generations. That takes time, and you adapt as things happen. That's in the worst-case scenarios. It's still going to take 100 years. That's a lot of time. One of the issues about the global warming controversy over the decades is how a lot of the pro-global warming scientists, the partisan ones, the ones who want to push it, they like to paint the Republican Party's position as if they're ignoring global warming, because Bush refuses to sign the Kyoto Accords, and that's an example of partisan.
Let me say this:
it's not analyzing why maybe the Bush administration doesn't want to sign Kyoto, not because it's going to solve global warming, but because it's a flawed treaty and doesn't really attack the problem.
All right. Well,
that's an argument that the Republicans make. A reasonable argument.
One of the things they said on 60 Minutes, Robert, was that the Bush administration is spending $5 billion a year on, on climate. What's going on?
Yes.
They're spending
a
lot of money.
That's ongoing, yes.
However, the results spent from that money would seem to indicate they ought to be doing something. And so one of the complaints is they're not.
Well, you see, the ones who say they're not doing anything, the doing that those people almost always want is sign the Kyoto Accords, as if that solves the problem. And the problem is that doesn't solve the problem. At least it's argued, and I think it's reasonably argued, if you analyze that specific treaty, that it's not going to solve the problem. The Kyoto Accords, the UN Kyoto Accords, are not a solution. All they appear to be, if you analyze it, is a tool for strengthening third world nations' economies and hurting the first world nations' economies. Redistribution of wealth, essentially. That's not solving this problem. Now, to say the Bush administration isn't doing anything, the fact is it hasn't been one party or the other in terms of the research. The ongoing research that NASA and many other, NOAA and other government agencies have been doing on this particular subject has been going on now for decades and is continuing to go on, and it has to do with that $5 billion of research. We need to know what is actually happening.
Whether
we know or not is still, I think, an open question. If global warming is happening and the data more recently seems to be leaning much better in that direction,
yes.
if it is happening, we still are not completely clear on why. There are a lot of unknowns there. And so to answer that question, I still think it's going to take at least a decade to get a clear idea. 5 years ago, I was saying it's going to take at least 15 years. I think we're getting closer, but it's going to take time to get that long-range sense of where the climate is going. And when we have, if you say 100 years, I'm sorry, I can't see myself standing on the ocean waiting 100 years to drown.
Okay.
This is something free society will adapt to very reasonably over time because we'll have the time to deal with it.
Mm.
You know, one of the arguments made by a lot of people in the last year or so is how warm it's been the last year and how we have these big hurricanes.
Oh, we do.
And that was done on 60 Minutes, and that was a perfect example of misstating what is known.
Because the meteorologists
are very clear on this. Hurricanes have very clearly followed a 40-year cycle since they've been studying them. They go up and they go down. You have heavy seasons and you have light periods.
Robert, uno momento. They did happen to mention that the ocean temperatures in that area are higher than they've ever recorded. Now,
hold on, Robert.
One at a time here. Let me finish. The hurricanes clearly get their energy from the high temperatures of the ocean.
Yes, that's
That's where it comes from. Yes. So higher temperatures, bigger storms. Yes. Duh. Right?
Yeah. Absolutely correct. But you see, once again, the meteorologists are very clear on this, that hurricanes have a clear cycle of hurricanes where you have heavy periods and light periods, and we're going through a heavy period right now, and that's following the cycle from 40 years ago. Well, we have only been measuring the temperatures of the oceans to this degree, to this specificness and clarity and detail for 40 years. We did not know precisely what the temperatures of the oceans were 40 years ago when we had that last heavy hurricane seasons. So once again, it's not 100% clear at this point whether this bad hurricane seasons we've had the last 2 years are because of global warming or because of natural cycle of the hurricane.
Well, I'll give you that. It's not totally clear.
That's my point. This is not to say we should ignore the problem. This is not to say that the problem doesn't exist. And it's not to say that global warming isn't happening. It's saying the situation is still somewhat unclear. And if you're going to take action, you need to know specifically against what. Especially if you're passing laws which restrict human freedom, you should at least know what you're doing. And we don't really know precisely yet. Everything I can see, we just don't know yet.
Suppose the day comes when even Robert Zimmerman says, all right, my back is broken. The latest is in. It's obvious. We're in big trouble. Then what?
Well, you also have to then start analyzing what are the specific consequences of the global warming you have predicted is going to occur. And a lot of it today is always addressed in doom and gloom. We're all going to die.
I
will say this. If I lived in Russia, for example.
Nobody said that.
They're always talking about how it's very bad. We're all going to be a foot underwater. We're going to get flooding. It's going to major hurricanes. It's always addressed
that's not everybody dies.
Well, I'm using a cliche of the attitude. It's doom and gloom, and it's a disaster we have to deal with. You yourself just said we're in deep trouble. Well,
Hold on a minute, Robert. I set up a question, a scenario, and I said, what if the day comes when Robert Zimmerman even says, all right, the evidence is in, we're in deep trouble?
See, but I'm going to take a step back, Art. I want to first ask...
Well, that's more like a step aside.
Wait, let me finish. We need to understand the process of global warming, or at least what is happening. Then we have to ask ourselves, well, what is the consequences of that? And if you start to break that down with some thought, you can figure out, well, we need to address this particular problem.
Mm.
But like if you live in Russia, you might actually be able to have better harvests and grow more food for
everybody. It's possible, yes. What I'm saying is, suppose we know we're going to get a New Orleans after a New Orleans after a New Orleans, that indeed one consequence is going to be gigantic, killer, bigger hurricanes.
Well, you can't deal specifically with hurricanes, but you can deal with, let's say, rising ocean. We have oceans rising because of the melting of Antarctica and Greenland, and that will be a predictable trend over time. It won't happen overnight. You then start attacking the coastal areas and approach and deal with how to prevent flooding on the coastal areas. Or you decide, well, we're going to let some coastal areas go and tell people they should sell their land, move. You deal with it, and it's not going to happen overnight. You know, you get hurricanes. Once again, we do not know if the hurricanes are a direct result of global warming, so that's a separate issue. In an area that's a hurricane area that's below sea level, such as New Orleans, it doesn't matter whether it's global warming or not. You have to deal with what is certain to come someday, and they hadn't, and they should have, and now they should. That is irrelevant to global warming. You live in a coastal area like Florida, you know hurricanes are coming through. Regardless, you deal with that. If the oceans are going to rise, you're going to have major flooding, then when we know that's for a fact, then you deal with it. Either you address it with levees, or you decide, well, this is not going to be worth saving. You then make those intelligent decisions when you know. It's not clear yet if that's happening.
And with respect to the causative factor, suppose it is decided that indeed greenhouse gases, from man, are a major portion of what's happening or adding to a natural cycle that's already underway, whatever.
Yeah. That's a tough one. It's a tough one only because I don't see our country or any country just by law outlawing cause. That more than anything else. I just don't see it happening. And it's a tough one. I do see a pattern in this respect, which is good, which is there's an effort for other political reasons having to do with the Middle East and oil to ease away from the use of fossil fuels in cars.
Mm-hmm.
Hybrid engines, the talk of fuel cells, which is still far down the road, but still there's talk of that. So those other factors might actually work to our advantage. As oil prices go up, it's absolutely the best thing in this respect because capitalism then will function. You have higher prices, it then becomes cost-effective to find alternatives, and those alternatives might solve the problem.
They might. Shouldn't there be, though, some political pressure from the top? I mean, after all, that is what a president is supposed to do, is look at the larger picture and direct the nation for the nation and citizens' good, right?
No, you're talking to a guy who doesn't quite believe that. A country that was bottom up. The president's supposed to take the leadership from the nation, from what the citizenry want.
Uh-huh.
And that's my perspective on this. I don't look to a great leader to tell me how to live my life.
So the top NASA guy on issues having to do with global warming and all the rest of it, this is the top NASA guy, starts making statements and gets muzzled. And so, Robert, I wonder what your take on that whole brouhaha is.
Well, I'll tell you, that was a very entertaining thing. There are several aspects. One, there were problems in the NASA Public Relations Office. Those problems were totally the result of a new administrator coming in and a complete shakeup, moving into different places, new people coming in, a lot of young new people coming in, some of whom were political appointees. And the shakeup brought about some actually very stupid policies in the NASA Public Relations Office that had nothing to do with the politics of global warming, just stupid interference. I'll tell a story. I was at a American Astronomical Society meeting. I'm in the press room, and the various public relations people for various NASA offices are complaining very loudly about the fact that they've been ordered, when they write press releases, these are people that work in different areas. They either work with the Hubble Space Telescope or the Chandra Space Telescope. They're not at headquarters, NASA headquarters.
Right.
And they work with the scientists, and their job is to report, to release press releases when a discovery is made. And they're complaining about how from on top, NASA headquarters press office has ordered them that in any press release they make, the first quote in the press release has to come from someone at NASA headquarters, which is absurd. Has nothing to do with the scientists who are doing the work, and they're complaining about it, and they have a valid complaint. So there were problems in that office, and it comes about, this stuff happens all the time. Every time you get a new president comes in, the first set of people who work for him, often you have a lot of these kind of problems.
So then,
Doctor, so that's the first thing about
Dr. Hansen is complaining for no reason other than what you just stated. In other words,
there's more to it than that.
That's part of it. And the rest of it?
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
The rest of it?
Well, the rest of it is this. Now, part of it is that the political appointee that the Bush administration hired, George Deutsch, that caused all the problems, he did lie on his resume. That indicates something about him. He was a little young, inexperienced, and he was trying to impose, I think, a little bit of the political. Michael Griffin, the administrator, said this recently, like a week ago at a press breakfast. He pointed out, you know, we want to be open, we want to let a scientist do things, but the scientists can't be making statements that are policy-oriented as if that's what NASA stands for. They have to separate their beliefs on what policy should be from what NASA's beliefs on policy. It's not their job to tell the world what NASA's policy is.
So what do you think? He was a little overzealous?
Deutsch got a little overzealous.
Overzealous, yeah.
But on the other side of it, you've got James Hansen, who has been, over the years, an extremely partisan, pro-global warming guy. Mm-hmm. A lot of his press stuff is infuriatingly overstating what we know. That's happened with him in the past. So you got it coming from both directions. I think in this case, most of the fault, though, was in the press office's overzealousness, they're trying to control policy statements from the scientists, and they overdid it, and they kind of Hansen got a little bit annoyed at that, and he also doesn't like the Bush administration because they won't sign the Kyoto Accords. So it's a little bit of both of those things all rolled up in one. And, you know, once again, the NASA press office should let scientists make their statements.
James Hansen is a scientist, and you know, he has all this concern, and you think that his concern is purely politically motivated, or do you think it's possible that as a top guy at NASA, he might know more than we do on the subject?
No, it's not purely political in nature, and he's worried about this issue, and he's been, you know, as a scientist, he came to the conclusion almost a decade ago that global warming is definitely happening, without question. He's been a proponent of that conclusion for a long time. A lot of other scientists, you know, want more data. I'm a more skeptic. But he, you know, and some scientists come to conclusions very early. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. He came to this conclusion, and he hasn't been proven wrong yet. None of the data has contradicted his conclusions. You could say that not all the data has conclusively proved he's right, but it's working in his direction. I won't deny that. So he's very strong in this, and he's worried about the issue. There's no question of that. And there are a lot of people sincerely worried about the issue.
Uh-huh.
They sometimes let the sad tragedy is if you spend any time among scientists, you find it's become almost irrational. It's very frustrating. They are all Democrats almost routinely. It's just a shame that's the case. So it puts them in kind of a bubble, and they're letting their party affiliations sometimes get the best of them, and that has happened too often. And I think there was an aspect of it.
Let's stop for a second. You said they're almost all Democrats.
Yes.
Surely you must have had some random thoughts about why that's true.
Yeah, I've had lots of thoughts about that. There's the same thing in the academic community. They're almost everyone is a Democrat. I was a teacher at three different colleges at different times, and let me tell you, if you are not a left wing Democrat, you keep your mouth shut if you want to keep your job.
And so you did, or having three jobs, you didn't.
I didn't, and that's why I don't teach there anymore.
I see.
You know, and it's become almost this is the irrationality that frustrates me. There's nothing wrong with being a partisan Democrat or a partisan Republican. It's the willingness to talk to each other and discuss it rationally and recognize that there's goodwill on both sides. I totally respect James Hansen's concerns about and the worries of those that believe global warming. It's a valid concern. You want to make sure we're prepared, and that's a good thing. Discussing it reasonably is also a good thing. You shouldn't paint those that are skeptical as blind and foolish about the issue and say, sign the Kyoto Accords and you've solved all our problems. You have to analyze it carefully and figure out what's the solution.
Well, I don't necessarily believe signing the Kyoto Accords would solve all the problems at all.
I
understand. I'm, by the way, so that you know, I'm a libertarian. You're obviously very conservative. And
I'm very libertarian.
From yeah, well, all right. You've come a long way. You've moved a long way since last time you were on the program. So I consider that actually progress for you.
Well, thank you. My approach always
welcome.
Is to look at the facts.
Uh-huh.
If the facts start to show a result in the direction of global warming, I'm going to say, sure. I'm still going to say, look, for example, there was a report a few weeks ago from Science about how the glaciers in Greenland have been shrinking.
Yes.
Dramatically.
Yes.
And so I, you know, tonight, because we're going to be on the show, I did a little bit of research, and I pulled up those reports, and I also pulled up the actual data, not the press releases and not the CBS reports, but the actual data.
Yes.
And if you look at the data closely, yes, there's no question that that if you were to weigh the balance of what the elevations of the glaciers in Greenland are, it seems to be going down.
Mm.
But if you look at the amount of data they have and the spread of the data, if you look at the data, you some way saying, well, oh, you know, it's not as clear-cut as they're saying. It's kind of, yes, maybe shrinking, but it's questionable still.
I have this vision, Robert, of you not admitting anything until the water is sloshing in your sneakers, you know, and still you're going to say, well, you know, yeah, there's some water here, but, you know, there's really no proof that it's going to keep getting higher.
Well, I'll give you another example. I was at a American Geophysical Union conference, which I had a guy. There was a guy, a scientist, giving a report about his modeling of how the seas are going to rise over the next decade, the next 150 years.
Yes.
And his model showed a graph going up steeply.
Mm-hmm.
And he then showed another graph, similar model, but the second graph had the dotted line as his prediction, and had a solid line under that about what had actually happened. And he passed that graph very quickly. But the graph showed what was actually happening was significantly below his model. And so, once again, you know, we say glaciers are shrinking in Greenland, but there's some, you know, it's not completely clear, and the oceans haven't actually been rising as fast as the prediction, or even rising based on the prediction. So, once again, I'm waiting for some solid information to convince me. When I
right.
have that, I will be convinced. I have no
that.
Problem with that.
All right, let's turn our attention to space in general and the Russians. There's a lot of talk in this country. In fact, I know some aerospace people that are actually hard at work right now on space tourism, on hotels in space. There are some incredible plans and people actually beginning to put together hardware in this country. And the Russians apparently are doing it too. What do you know?
The Russians, about a week and a half ago, they signed a deal with a company. It's a multi-international deal. The company is called Space Adventures. They're the people that sent Denis Tito up to Mir using Russian rockets.
Right.
And they sent Shuttleworth and recently Greg Olson, and they're going to send a Japanese up in two or three months. They're the only company at this moment that's actually sent tourists into space. And they've worked closely with the Russians over the last few years, doing this successfully, making money for the Russians and money for themselves, and providing and fulfilling a need because wealthy people wanted to go into space.
And ticking off NASA.
Originally ticking off NASA. NASA's kind of like accepted the reality that they don't rule the world in space for Americans, and Americans, if they wish to go, have the right to go. And so NASA's backed off a little bit on that, thank goodness.
Yes.
However, Space Adventures is more linked with an international community. So last week they signed a deal that involved not just they announced a deal that didn't just involve the Russians, it also involved the United Arab Emirates.
Uh-huh.
Really fascinating combination of money and power.
And the deal?
Say again?
The deal?
Oh, the deal is this. A Russian company is going to build a rocket called Explorer, and it's going to be a multi-stage. It'll take off similar to Spaceship One off a plane, and they'll send the second stage up to get a suborbital flight. And it's reusable, much like the shuttle. It'll have a lifting body shape, so it'll come down and glide to the landing. That's going to be built by a Russian Russian company. But the spaceport is going to take place in one of the United Arab Emirates, Ras El Khaimah. Now, if you look at the Saudi Peninsula and the Strait of Hormuz that goes past Iraq,
yes.
At the very eastern end, there's a little point peninsula that sticks up into the strait. Well, the western half of that is the little tiny area that's controlled by Ras Al Khaimah. That's one of the United Arab Emirates. Essentially, it's a bunch of tribal guys who got together. They're tribal leaders, and they put together a country, the United Arab Emirates. And they have made a deal with Space Adventures that they're going to provide the spaceport. Now, there's more to this. It's more interesting.
No.
Some of the money's coming from the Ansara family. Now, that name doesn't ring a bell. I'll remind people that. And it wasn't the XPRIZE that Burt Rutan's company won with Spaceship One. It was the Ansari XPRIZE. The Ansari family's got a lot of money. It's Arab. It's got Arab roots. And they're some of the financial backing to this whole Space Adventures deal. And it's in the money of $265 million to build a spaceport, to build Explorer, the Russian ship, and to put them up from the UAE. So it's really interesting. And they say they're going to get their first ship up by 2008, and they're in a race to beat Virgin Galactic. That's Richard Branson's company that signed a deal with Burt Rutan's company.
That's pretty exciting.
The ship. So it's very exciting. By 2008, we could see suborbital tourist flights. We have two different companies at least of big money. Actually, there's more than that. I mean, in Oklahoma City, there's a third company. A lot of engineers I've talked to are very skeptical about rocket planes' ability to succeed. They've basically taken a Learjet as their rocket ship, and they're going to send it up to suborbital heights. And there's a lot of engineers who are skeptical. Well, this is going to happen in Oklahoma City, and they also have people who've given them money who want to fly on them. And they have a deal with Oklahoma, a tax deal, to have a spaceport in Oklahoma City. So you got a third company going. And then you have Jeff Bezos of Amazon.com, and he's very quiet, but his company is putting together a spaceport in the southern area, very southern tips of Texas.
No kidding.
Yes. He's very quiet. But they're building a ship, and they're putting a spaceport together, but he's not talking about it very much, but he has the cash. On top of that, I'll always like to bring up SpaceX, Space Exploration Incorporated. SpaceX is Elon Musk's company, and he is like, he's not building reusable ships for tourism. He's building rockets to just put satellites in orbit, just make money. Mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. if he can make it work, he will cut the cost of satellite orbit by a third, and he'll start to make a lot of money, and his goal is the same as all the others.
Robert, NASA's private dominion, almost, has been space.
Yes.
And you're quoting all these various private efforts that are cranking up right now. When it begins to happen, how do you think NASA and the U.S. government and other governments around the world are going to react to invasion of their private territory?
Well, NASA's first reaction a few years ago when Dennis Tito went up, and I talked about this extensively in Leaving Earth, my book.
Right.
Their reaction was abysmally offensive to me. They tried to stop it.
Oh, yes.
They tried to stop it. The attitude in recent years has been to back off and let it happen. They know they can't. The question isn't so much what NASA's going to do, it's what the U.S. government's going to do. And they've passed laws which I think are going to make it hard. One of the reasons the Space Adventures company, I think, went to the United Arab Emirates for their spaceport is because U.S. law, the law they passed last year to supposedly help commercial space,
yes.
is a hindrance. Mm-hmm. And I think they recognize that, and they went someplace where they wanted to deal with all this regulation. And that's where we have to worry. I'm hoping that the exuberance of the success of this kind of stuff will encourage Congress to pass laws that will reduce the problem.
Look, isn't it almost fair to say that NASA and the government really are one? And if NASA thinks it's their private dominion, then the laws we've seen passed, well, they've been directed by, encouraged by NASA. It's all one government.
You could be right.
I could be.
But yeah. I would say this, that Michael Griffin might disagree with you based on his testimony and the Congress's reaction to his budget the last few weeks. They're not necessarily in agreement. Though, I think, though, in this case, because it's a fiefdom, it's their little empire, and the government likes controlling that little empire, I wouldn't disagree with you, really. Mm-hmm. And so we'll see. I go from pessimism to optimism periodically on this subject, though. I'm hopeful. I will say this, though. It's discouraging from an American's point of view that they have to go to the United Arab Emirates to set up a spaceport. They have to go to the Russians to get a rocket ship. It's discouraging that companies like Boeing and Lockheed don't have the innovation anymore to chip in and make this happen.
Well, from their point of view, all hell's breaking loose. I mean, look at the Chinese.
Oh, yes, the Chinese are pushing forward on a steady, though very, I think, a somewhat slow pace. They could pick it up if they wanted to. But nonetheless, they're demonstrating that it can be done and that they will do it. And where are we? I mean, you know, right now there's a court suit between Elon Musk's SpaceX company and Boeing and Lockheed, because Boeing and Lockheed have their own rockets, the Delta and the Atlas. They're made by each company. And the military wanted to have those two different rockets to give them some redundancy and have competition. And Boeing and Lockheed decided last year that they're going to get together and form a partnership, and the military will only have one company to choose from. And the military's kind of said, okay, and the government wants to go along with this.
Yes.
And it's not innovative, it's not competitive, and Musk, who's trying to make a rocket to compete with these guys, is suing the military and the government for non-competitive practices. And he's, unfortunately, last week, I think it's unfortunate in my mind, his case was thrown out. Now they're going to appeal again, but unfortunate that Boeing and Lockheed's approach to competition is to try to form a cartel and not be innovative.